Hello, hello, hello. Here's Marlanka again with another episode from Sri Aurobindo's essays, Divine and Human. Continuing from the last reading, he's speaking about stilling the mind, meditation, only old thoughts arising, and if the process be farther pursued by rejecting thoughts as they rise in the mind, in other words, by dissociating the thinker from the mind, the operator from the machine, and refusing to sanction the continuance of the machine's activity, the result is perfect stillness. This can be done if the thinker whose interest is necessary to the mind refuses to be interested and becomes passive. The mind goes on for a while by its own impetus, just as a locomotive does when the steam is shut off, but a time must come when it will slow down and stop altogether. This is the moment towards which the process moves. Na kinchid api chintayet. The yogin should not think of anything at all. Blank cessation of mental activity is aimed at leaving only the sakshi, the witness, watching for results. If at this moment the yogin entrusts himself to the guidance of the universal teacher within himself, yoga will fulfill itself without any farther effort on his part. The passivity will be confirmed. The higher faculties will awake, and the cosmic force passing down from the Vijnana through the supermind will take charge of the whole machine and direct its workings as the infinite Lord of all may choose. Whichever of the two methods be chosen, the result is the same. The mind is stilled, the higher faculties awakened. This stillness of the mind is not altogether a new idea or peculiar to India. The old Highland poets had the secret. When they wished to compose poetry, they first stilled the mind and became entirely passive and waited for the inspiration to flow into them. This habit of yogic passivity, a relic doubtless of the discipline of the Druids, was the source of those faculties of second sight and other psychic powers which are so much more common in this Celtic race than in the other peoples of Europe. The phenomena of inspiration are directly connected with these higher faculties, of which we find rudiments or sporadic traces in the past history of human experience. The swiftness of the muse has been embodied in the image of Pegasus, the heavenly horse of Greek legend. It was from the rapid beat of his hoofs on the rock that Hippocrene flowed. The waters of poetry flow in a current, or a torrent. Where there is a pause or a denial, it is a sign of obstruction in the stream, or of imperfection in the mind, which the waters have chosen for their bed and continent. In India, we have the same idea. Saraswati is for us the goddess of poetry, and her name means the stream, or she who has flowing motion. But even Saraswati is only an intermediary. Ganga is the real mother of inspiration, she who flows impetuously down from the head of Mahadev, God, high-seated, over the Himalaya of the mind to the homes and cities of men. All poetry is an inspiration, a thing breathed into the thinking organ from above. It is recorded in the mind, but is born in the higher principle of direct knowledge or ideal vision, which surpasses mind. is, in reality, a revelation. The prophetic, or revealing power, sees the substance. The inspiration perceives the right expression. Neither is manufactured. Nor is poetry really a poesis, or composition, nor even a creation, but rather the revelation of something that eternally exists. The ancients knew this truth and used the same word for poet and prophet, creator and seer, sophos, vates, kavi. But there are differences in the manifestation. The greatest motion of poetry comes when the mind is still, and the ideal principle works above and outside the brain, above even the hundred-petaled lotus of the ideal mind, in its proper empire. For then it is Veda that is revealed, the perfect substance and expression of eternal truth. This higher ideation transcends genius just as genius transcends ordinary intellect and perception. But that great faculty is still beyond the normal level of our evolution. Usually, we see the action of the revelation and inspiration reproduced by a secondary, diluted, and uncertain process in the mind. But even this secondary and inferior action is so great that it can give us Shakespeare, Homer, Valmiki. And there is also a tertiary and yet more common action of the inspiration. For of our three mental instruments of knowledge, the heart, or emotionally realizing mind, the observing and reasoning intellect with its aids, fancy and memory, and the intuitive intellect. It is into the last and highest that the ideal principle transmits its inspirations when the greatest poetry writes itself out through the medium of the poet. But if the intuitive intellect is not strong enough to act habitually, it is better for the poetry to descend into the heart and return to the intellect, suffused and colored with passion and emotion, than to be formed directly in the observing intellect. And poetry written from the reasoning intellect is apt to be full of ingenious conceits, logic, argumentation, rhetorical turns, ornamental fancies, echoes learned and imitative rather than uplifted and transformed. This is what is sometimes called classical poetry, the vigorous and excellent but unemotional and unuplifted poetry of Pope and Dryden. It has its inspiration, its truth and value. It is admirable in its way, but it's only great when it is lifted out of itself into intuitive writing, or else invaded by the heart. For everything that needs fire rather than light, driving force rather than clearness, enthusiasm rather than correctness, the heart is obviously the more potent instrument. Now, poetry to be great must have either enthusiasm or ecstasy. Yet the poetry that rises up from the heart is usually a turbid stream. Our own restless ideas and imaginations mix with the pure inrush from above, a turbulent uprush from below. Our excited emotions seek an exaggerated expression. Our aesthetic habits and predilections busy themselves to demand satisfaction greatly beyond their due. Now, such poetry may be inspired, but it is not always suitable or inevitable. There's often a double inspiration, the higher, or ecstatic, and the lower, or emotional. And the lower disturbs and drags down the higher. Now, this is the birth of romantic or excessively exuberant poetry, too rich in expression, too abundant and redundant in substance. The best poetry, coming straight from the right centers, may be bare and strong, unadorned and lofty, or it may be rich and splendid. It may be, at will, romantic or classical, but it will always be felt to be the right thing for its purpose. It is always nobly or rapturously inevitable. But even in the higher centers of the intuitive intellect, there may be defects in the inspiration. There's a kind of false fluency which misses the true language of poetry from dullness of perception. Under the impression that it is true and inspired writing, it flows, but with an imperturbable flatness, saying the thing that should be said, but not in the way that it should be said, without force, without felicity. This is the tamasic or clouded stimulus, active, but full of unenlightenment and self-ignorance. The thing seen is right and good, accompanied with the inspired expression, it would make very noble poetry. But instead it becomes prose, rendered unnatural and difficult to tolerate by being cut up into lengths. Wordsworth is the most characteristic and interesting victim of tamasic stimulus. Other great poets fall a prey to it, but that superb and imperturbable self-satisfaction under the infliction of his is his alone. There is another species of tamasic stimulus which transmits an inspired and faultless expression, but the substance is neither interesting to man nor pleasing to the gods. A good deal of Milton comes under this category. Now, in both cases, what has happened is that either the inspiration or the revelation has been active, but its companion activity has refused to associate itself in the work. It is when the mind works at the form and substance of poetry without either the revelation or the inspiration from above that respectable or minor poetry is produced. Judgment, memory, and imagination may work. Command of language may be there, but without that secondary action of a higher than intellectual force. Why, it is labor wasted. Work that earns respect, but not immortality. Doggerel and bastard poetry take their rise not even in the observing intellect, but from the sensational mind, or the passive memory guided only by the mere physical pleasure of sound and emotion. It's bold, blatant, external, imitative, vulgar. Its range of intellectuality and imaginativeness cannot go beyond the vital impulse and the vital delight. But even in the sensational mind, there is the possibility of a remote action from the ideal self. For even to the animals who think sensationally only, God has given revelations and inspirations which we call instincts. Under such circumstances, even bastard poetry may have a kind of worth, a kind of inevitability. The poet in the sensational man may be entirely satisfied and delighted, and even in the more developed human being, the sensational element may find a poetical satisfaction, but not of the highest. The best ballad poetry and Macaulay's lays are instances in point. And Scott is a sort of link between sensational and intellectual poetry. While there are men mainly sensational, secondarily intellectual, and not at all ideal, he will always be admired. We will stop for today and continue in the next episode, hoping that you are enjoying Sri Aurobindo's essays, Divine and Human. And thank you for listening. Bye for now.
This is Auroville Radio, voices from the city of Dawn.